You're listening to the MOA broadcast with Sam Wilson. Will you make it out alive? All right, we are back from the break. Now, before the break, we mentioned the 10 C's of survival. C as in Charlie, the 10 C's of survival. Now, we mentioned this in our last episode as well. Going to go ahead and flesh that out a little bit more in this episode. So what are the 10 C's of survival? Number of people over the years have done various versions of this list. Basically, it's just an easy way to keep in mind a handful of essentials that you should have with you whenever you go out into the backwoods. As we've seen a number of times in this program, that oftentimes people, one of the things that gets people the most is they're just simply not prepared to make it out alive. And yet again, that is the purpose of the show. It's not just about having some particular tool, having some particular, you know, skill or toy or whatever. It's about a prepared mindset and thinking about what could go wrong before it happens. That's how you make it out alive. It's not just having the latest and the greatest in technology. It's really about preparing, you know, expecting the unexpected, as Dalton would say. So let's get into a brief story. We go to the Adirondack Mountains in upstate New York. Now, for those of you outside the U.S., as we have a number of international listeners, most people, when they think of New York, they think of New York City, and maybe even more specifically, Manhattan, which is called the city in New York. Upstate New York, and upstaters will be very quick to tell you this very loudly, is very different from New York City. You start getting upstate, it starts getting more rural. Even though there are cities, it's just a very, very different atmosphere and type of people and situation and whatever you want to call it from being in the city, okay? That being said, if you're ever upstate, especially near Rochester, I want to recommend getting yourself a garbage plate. It's been a number of years now since I've had one, but I think there were meat. Basically, it's like a big bowl or plate of comfort food. There's meat, cheese, potatoes, and I seem to remember quite a bit of hot sauce. It goes down really good with a couple of beers. So if you're in New York, especially upstate, get yourself a garbage plate and thank me later. You'll enjoy it. All right, now we go to the Adirondacks. We're not going to use this lady's name. Unfortunately, she did not make it out alive. But the female hiker of Delaware was found dead on McNaughton Mountain in the Adirondacks on Saturday. She may have been a very experienced hiker, reports say, but according to other reports, she was not adequately prepared for a winter hike in the Adirondack High Peaks. These are mountains that are around 5,000 feet, not extremely tall. But the minute you start getting a little bit of elevation, weather can be very unpredictable. So she was in the Adirondack High Peaks, around 5,000 feet, of Wilmington, Delaware. She has been described by those who know her as an avid hiker who was experienced and passionate about mountaineering. She went hiking in the Adirondack High Peaks region on Friday and was reported missing on Saturday morning when she was supposed to meet with a group of hikers. Unfortunately, her body was found later in the day on McNaughton Mountain, assuming I'm pronouncing that correctly. The coroner who did her case said she was not properly dressed, wearing only a pair of sneakers for footwear. She was wearing drawstring fleece sweatpants, and her clothes were reportedly soaked through. She also did not have gear such as a space blanket or good fire-starting material. So we already know where this is going, but what is the point? She was not prepared. I don't understand. I guess maybe it goes back to when the ultralight movement of hiking started, you know, kind of making its way in. Used to, you know, 30, 40 years or more ago, when people went hiking or backpacking, they had these big, thick, heavy leather boots that were, you know, basically they were almost mountaineering boots in a lot of cases, but they were hiking boots. Very heavy. And for someone just going on a day hike, it was kind of overkill. And if you were going to be doing like a through trail or going on a long backpacking trip, especially on very well-established trails, these boots were overkill. They were very heavy. And what happened is if you were at elevation, you were around snow a lot, you had to keep waterproofing these boots. Otherwise, the leather would start absorbing moisture and it would just become a mess. They would never, ever dry out because it's so cold and so wet. And it would just, they very quickly became very heavy, very cumbersome, very cold because they're soaked and they're freezing. So then you would fill them with waterproofer, whether it's mink oil or neatsfoot oil or whatever in the world was available at the time. Snow Seal came out, yada, yada, yada. And the boots just kept getting heavier and heavier, and it was kind of an ordeal. And so ultralight hiking kind of came out, and guys started. I think Jardine was one of the first guys, if memory serves me, but I haven't read some of these books in a long time, so forgive me if I'm incorrect. But they started pushing wearing tennis shoes to go hiking, because especially on very well-established trails, and if you're not mountaineering or anything, it was very easy to get by on a weekend hike or even a several-day hike wearing tennis shoes. They're very comfortable. More importantly, they were very light, and they provided enough support if you were going ultralight. Ultralight meaning a backpack weight of, maybe 10, 15, 18 pounds or something like that, maybe 20, 25 pounds fully loaded, which is not that much if you're a decent size and you're an experienced backpacker. So the tennis shoe thing kind of became popular, but this was before we had the technology we have now, the advancements in synthetic materials and shoes and so forth. These were just regular old tennis shoes. So guys would sometimes wear through these, in a couple of days or weeks, and they would have another pair waiting for them at their next drop, their supply drop. Now we have shoes that are hybrids, between like regular boots and hiking boots and duty boots and tennis shoes. They cover a lot of different things while giving you the support you need, but they're much lighter, waterproof, and so forth. That being said, I do not understand for the life of me why so many people are wearing tennis shoes on these trails. I was always taught growing up that footwear is absolutely one of the most important things, because if your feet or ankles fail you, you are in serious trouble. And if you're uncomfortable and your feet are hurting, it's just going to go downhill from there. On my hundreds of miles, if not more, on the Oregon trails alone in the last couple of years, I cannot tell you how many people I've seen in open-toed hiking shoes. The thing with that is I know a lot of people are going to be fans of open-toed sandals and so forth. It's one of those things where it's just fine until it isn't. Then when the chips are down, like this poor lady, she's wearing sweatpants and tennis shoes at 5,000 feet. Okay? That's not acceptable. And unfortunately, that contributed. We don't know exactly what happened, but it contributed to her loss of life. So let's get in to the 10 C's. The first one, let's pull up the list here. We're going to go through and we'll name each category and then we'll kind of flesh it out as we go on. The first one is a cutting tool. That basically means a knife. We'll come back to that one later. Knives are everyone's favorite topic to discuss, so we'll get to that in a moment. Next, we have a combustion device, cover or shelter, a container, cordage, candling, cotton material, cargo tape, compass, and a canvas needle. Now, we aren't going to have time. We could spend, we could easily spend hours going through this list and the items involved here. We'll go through some of them. So, a cutting tool. Okay, let's just jump right in. That's almost everyone, when you talk to guys about the outdoors, okay, either the gun or the knife is the big, it's the hot rod. It's the showpiece they want to talk about and fantasize about and go through. We'll keep this simple. I'm a professional knife maker. I've been making knives for nearly 15 years now, professionally and full-time for a very good portion of that. The level of quality that we have with any decent piece of cutlery, whether it's custom-made, factory-made, is so much higher in a lot of ways than stuff we've had in the past that if you buy any decent, good-quality piece of cutlery or knife, you're going to be okay. In most cases, what gets people is not the failure of their cutting tool. In fact, I have read easily hundreds of these survival stories that I share each week in the MOA broadcast. In most of them that I come across, the people don't even have a knife. Whether they live or die, they don't even have a knife on them. So I'm not discounting the importance of a cutting tool, especially a quality one. But you don't want to go, you know, lose your mind over this. Obviously, if you're a knife aficionado, if you like knives and that's where you spend your money, then the sky is the limit. You can buy knives anywhere from $30 on up to thousands of dollars, depending on what you want to spend. In my mind, if you're buying a quality brand, I'm not going to name names for the purpose of this broadcast other than my own Wilson Custom Knives or Techline Knives, obviously, because I believe in what I do. If you're buying a decent, especially if it's an American-made piece, between $50 and $150, you're getting a good quality knife, most likely. You can go from there on up to $300 to $500 or more, depending on what you want to spend. But if you buy a $10 knife from, you know, the cheapo box store, you're gonna get probably what you expect, okay? So spend a couple of dollars. It doesn't have to be fancy. If you like knives, and obviously you can spend more, but it doesn't have to be fancy to work and to be utilitarian. It's the, most of these situations are not like the survival scenarios we see in movies and books where the knife is the thing that made the difference in whether they survived or not. That isn't usually the reality of the situation. More often than not, it's about being prepared. That being said, a good full tang knife, I make hollow handle survival knives. I have a lot of faith in the knives that I've designed and made over the years. I've got tests where I beat them with axe handles and ball bats. I do chin-ups on them. The important thing, again, is not so much what which particular knife you get. As long as it's decent quality, it's more about how you use it and the other things you have involved in your kit and the way you've prepared for the situation. So we'll get on to this cutting tool. That kind of covers a cutting tool. A combustion device was number two. We covered this last week in our episode on fire. You're going to want at least two different methods for fire starting, because the old saying is two is one and one is none. If you only have one disposable lighter or one whatever your fire starting device is, if anything happens to it or you lose it, you now have zero. Okay, so two is one, one is none. The next is going to be cover or shelter. Obviously, we've done several of these stories where if the people have been able to keep the snow and or the rain and these razor sharp winds from cutting through off of them, they would have lessened the impact of the exposure that they were facing. So keeping the wind off, I mean, that wind will lower your body temperature, can take away moisture, all kinds of problems. So cover and shelter is going to be very important. The next, a container. This applies more specifically in most cases to a water bottle. So whenever I go out, I have at least, even though I have multiple different water vessels with me, I always have one stainless steel canteen. Okay. And the reason for this being, I can boil it if need be. It's going to be durable. Sometimes your plastic bladders can get punctured and then you lose not only the water you had in them, but then the potential for future gathering of water. So I like to have at least one metal container. That way I can boil water in it if need be. If I run out of either my filter gets broken or I don't have water purification tablets, I can put water right into the canteen and boil it and I've got clean water. So that's important. Candling. This refers to a candle. I don't think most people are going to take candles, although we do have emergency candles for maybe inside your tent or other situations if you have adequate ventilation. But basically, this means a light source. Every one of my kits have multiple little flashlights, whether it's inside one of my waterproof hollow handle survival knives, if it's inside of a little tin, if it's in a Ziploc bag, whatever you've got, you should have multiple sources of light, because you would be surprised how quickly you become basically paralyzed out in the wilderness if you can't see. All you have is artificial or natural light, once the sun goes down, you're done until the morning. Now, if you've got good moonlight, you can do some things, but it does not take the place of a good flashlight. Cargo tape. This refers primarily to duct tape. Duct tape is a great resource. Duct tape can be used, obviously, for taping things, for binding things. It can even be used for splinting. Duct tape also burns very well in most cases. Again, check your particular tape. I like taking along duct tape and some gaffer's tape. If you're not familiar with that, gaffer's tape, G-A-F-F-E-R, gaffer's tape. It's very similar to duct tape. Pardon me. Very similar to duct tape. It's a cloth-based type tape. but it does not leave the residue that duct tape leaves behind. I've got a roll of duct tape in all my bags, and in the truck, in the shop, everywhere. It's very handy stuff. And again, doesn't leave all that adhesive behind. The duct tape does. And then finally, we missed one here, cotton material. This basically refers to a bandana type item or something similar that can be used for making a sling. You can do some very rudimentary water purification with this, a head covering, neck or throat covering if it's windy, and so forth. We get to compass. Obviously, we don't need to explain the importance of a compass, but this is what I'll say about a compass. Even more important than having a quality compass is know how to use it. I have been hiking with a number of people who had, most of them did not have a compass of any kind other than the GPS on their phone. The ones that did have a compass, with maybe one or two exceptions, had no idea how to use it. Because it's more than just knowing, okay, I know which way north or south is now. What does that mean if you don't know where you are or where you're going or where you've been? So again, like all these items, have some experience and plan ahead. Use them and prepare with them. And then finally, a canvas needle or a sail needle. This is great for making repairs. You can even do some very minor surgery like getting out splinters or contaminants out of your flesh or out of a wound with these. They're good for puncturing as well. Again, do some research. Look up the 10 C's of survival. There's a lot of good information that we just won't have time to cover in depth. Remember, when you look at how you prioritize your 10 C's of survival or your kits or your bag, whatever, remember the rule of threes, okay? This is a very widely accepted rule in the backwoods and the world of survival, okay? You can go roughly, these are estimates, obviously. You can go 3 hours without shelter. That means exposed to the elements. 3 hours without shelter, 3 days without water, and 3 weeks without food. Now, obviously, that's not written in stone, but that gives you an idea as to your priorities. Get yourself protected. Regulating your body temperature is extremely important. Regulate your body temperature, then worry about water to keep yourself hydrated. Food is usually a distant third. By far, the vast majority of these survival scenarios last 48 to 72 hours. Now, that's not saying they don't ever go the distance, but usually food is the least of your worries. Injury, exposure, and dehydration are what wind up getting people usually. So, just something to keep in mind. Okay, we are going to finish on a high note here. Let's go to our final story of the day. This takes us to Victoria, Australia. A 7-foot kangaroo puts farmer in headlock and beats him up. I'm sorry, I'm not going to use this guy's real name. I'm not going to make fun of him anymore. I'm sure he's already been given it to him by his buddies. But let's just get into it. A man in his 70s was attacked by a kangaroo and has been left scarred by the macho marsupial. The report states, we'll just call him Terry. Terry, 74, was riding his motorcycle across his farm in the Australian state of Victoria on Saturday night when the kangaroo began following him. The kangaroo measured around 7 feet tall by Terry's estimations and started growling and jumping up and down, he told the local news station. Next thing I know, he was on top of me, Terry said. He had his top paws right around my back. We were almost headbutting each other. I just kept punching him until he let me go and he jumped away. According to Terry. So this guy is riding his motorcycle on his property and a 7-foot-tall kangaroo jumps out, grabs a hold of him and gets him in a headlock and starts headbutting him while he's punching him at the same time. Okay, let's go. We continue. Terry made a break for it, barely making it onto his motorcycle before the kangaroo charged for a second time. One more jump, and he would have been on top of me again, Terry says. The man was rushed to local hospital where he received stitches, bandages, and antibiotics. His shirt was torn up by the attack. If he hadn't had on a thick shirt, the abrasions would have been much more severe, Terry's wife said. So this kangaroo had a real bad attitude. I don't know what Terry did or didn't do, but it wasn't enough to tear him up once. The kangaroo came back for seconds. Okay, kangaroos, let's go into the technical side of this. Kangaroos can reach sizes of up to 200 pounds and around 7 feet tall, depending on the species. According to experts, they are powerful animals. Most attacks involve kicking people, leading to bruising and puncture wounds from their sharp toe claws. The sorts of injuries, Verns said, some expert, I don't know where the rest of his name is in this article, the sorts of injuries this guy received is typical. It was a bit strange that he was attacked repeatedly. Usually the kangaroo realizes its mistake, i.e. that you're not a kangaroo, you're a human, and that's the end of it. But apparently this kangaroo really wanted a piece of Terry, and he got it, folks. Speaking of kangaroo fighting tactics, their words, not mine, kangaroo fighting tactics, the headlock is what male kangaroos do. They kick and rake with their feet and then try to throw their opponents with their powerful forearms. So the headlock, punch and kick you, and then judo slam you to the ground. I don't even really know why. So we get into this. This is something I didn't know. Alessia Carter, an associate professor in evolutionary anthropology at University College London, says kangaroo males don't protect females or the group, from what I've seen. They're simply protecting their potential to have a baby. So just being close to a mob, which is what a group of kangaroos are called, is enough to trigger this behavior. So maybe Terry rode through, there were some other females around, and Kangaroo Jack didn't like the cut of his jib, and he took it out on them repeatedly. I don't know. But apparently they don't do this to protect other kangaroos. It's just a matter of protecting mating potential. So be forewarned, Terry. Do not go back around Kangaroo Jack. Would pepper spray deter a kangaroo? I don't know. We won't have time to explore it in this episode, but we will get to it in another episode. That is going to do it for us today, folks. Remember, be forewarned. That is forearmed. Make sure you are prepared ahead of time to make it out alive, because if you don't make it out alive, you don't make it out at all.